Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time.
Today on the AAMFT podcast, we are tackling an often overlooked but critical topic: the experiences, challenges, and training needs of MFT supervisors of color. Despite ongoing discussions about the need for greater racial diversity in our field, MFT continues to be predominantly composed of white practitioners. While much has been written about the experiences of racially minoritized students and therapists, far less attention has been given to supervisors of colors, those guiding the next generation of systemic therapists while navigating their own unique challenges. Today on the podcast, I'm going to be joined by our expert panelists, Dr. Leslie Anderson and Dr. Carmen Smith. We're going to share their research findings from a recent Journal of Marital and Family Therapy article and their personal insights into the barriers that supervisors of color face, the sociocultural dynamics that shape supervisory relationships, and the ways in which current training models may fall short. Most importantly, we'll discuss actionable steps to better support, train, and uplift systemic supervisors of color. Because when supervision is inclusive and equitable, both our profession and our clients benefit. Leslie Anderson joined us on season two of the podcast when she was a doctoral student. Now she is an assistant professor of family and consumer sciences at Morgan State University and an LMFT with over 10 years of clinical experience, primarily serving Black youth and family. Dr. Anderson earned her PhD in human development with an emphasis in MFT from the University of Georgia. As a scientist practitioner, her program of research focuses on the intersection of Black familial processes, race and racism, and psychological well-being. Specifically, she investigates how racial socialization and positive racial identity act as protective factors against racial harm and injury. Her colleague, Dr. Carmen Smith, received her PhD in couple and family therapy from Antioch University in New England. She earned both her bachelor's in psychology and her master's in mental health counseling with a specialization in MFT from the University of South Florida. She's also a recipient of the AAMFT Dissertation Completion Minority Fellowship and a mentor for the Minority Fellowship Program, which both Carmen and Leslie will talk about today. They're not only relationships made, but knowledge gained by being part of such a great program that we've mentioned on the podcast from time to time. Carmen is also the membership chair for the Groves Conference on Marriage and Family. She's also passionate about research and promotes the awareness of the intersectionality of mental illness, substance abuse, and social injustice. This is a conversation long overdue. So whether you are a supervisor of color or a supervisor general or a supervisee, this is such a worthwhile listen. Let's dive in. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. So happy to be joined by return guest. Back when she was a doctoral student, now she is a full academic MFT. That's Dr. Leslie Anderson and her colleague, Dr. Carmen Smith. We're talking about a great article that they wrote in the Journal of Marital and Family Therapy, JMFT, The Unspoken Experiences of Systemic Supervisors of Color. We love to talk about supervision. It is one of the things that makes our profession of systemic therapy, MFT, distinct in how we do supervision. But we are going to talk today not only about their article, but about real life clinical implications of that work and their research. So welcome to the show, ladies. The first question is always for our listeners, tell us about your MFT origin story. How did you get to be in this great profession that we all love so much?
Sure. I'm happy to start us off. And thank you, Eli, for inviting us to be on to talk about the article. Like you mentioned, I was on the podcast some years ago as a doc student at the University of Georgia. So that's where I got my degree. But before that, I was in Mississippi, which is where I'm originally from. So I got my master's in marriage and family therapy back in 2012, which is super hard to believe, but I did not pursue my doctorate until 2016 and finished up in 2020. And initially entering the field, I think I was very passionate, but also ignorant to a lot of things. I knew that I was interested in wanting to work with couples, addressing issues around infidelity and betrayal and those types of challenges. And now, if I'm being transparent, most of my work is actually with individuals, primarily Black women, navigating life and all the stressors that come with life. But systemic practice is really important to me. And I got a chance to work with wonderful colleagues on this paper. So yeah, that's a little bit about my origin story.
Yeah, thank you so much, Leslie. And Carmen, what is your origin story?
Thank you again for this opportunity. And I am a Florida native and began my journey at the University of South Florida in Tampa campus. And my undergraduate degree is in psychology. And then I went on to my master's degree in rehabilitation and mental health counseling. And it was in that program where I discovered MFT and systems thinking and cybernetics. And I felt found. Things just didn't quite line up when I was looking at mental health from an individual or medical model. And I was that one that was always asking questions about interpersonal dynamics and relationships and how does this apply to couples and family. And so when I was able to take my first class in my grad program, that was when I shifted and moved into the marriage and family therapy certificate program that was offered there. So in my master's, I graduated with my certificate in MFT. And then I went on to Antioch University in Keene, New Hampshire, where I completed my doctoral degree in marriage and family therapy. So my journey took me from those psychological origins and still feeling lost and really wanting to know more about how to better support families into finding marriage and family therapy and then beginning work primarily in adoptive populations. When I was doing my internships, I was working with families that were either seeking adoption or had been separated for different reasons or different cases with the state and were working on reunification. So from there on, I became more interested in transracial adoptions and supporting families that were either in the process of that or post-adoption. And I would say that in my private practice, about 20% of my caseload is transracial adoptive families, and maybe 10% couples work that I'm doing, and the rest would be individual from a systems perspective.
And what got you guys interested in what we're going to talk about today? We're going to speak the unspoken today, but the unspoken experiences of supervisors of color. Obviously, what we do as family therapists and research, this type of research, especially qualitative research, is so fascinating for me to consume and read because it speaks to me as really what the work looks like. And I think it's probably doesn't get its due in the field, but our great journal like JMFT creates space for it. But what got you interested even in wanting to do this type of research?
So for me, honestly, I think it goes back to entering a supervision of supervision course that I think most folks in MFT doc programs have as they're matriculating. But we actually were doing something really unique at Georgia at the time, where we were actually inviting master's and social work students into our family therapy clinic on campus. And these were students who were interested in doing systemic work, and they were being supervised by those of us who were PhD students. And I just started to really pay attention to the various dynamics at play. So for one, you had master's level social work students entering a space of systemic thinkers and thinking about conceptualizing cases very differently than they were. So that was one really unique dynamic. Then thinking about gender dynamics, sexual orientation, and also dynamics around race and age as well. So it was really in part my observations as a student in a doctoral program going through a supervision of supervision class, and the conversations that we were having around race and around identity, I found myself struggling with experiencing things around identity and microaggressions as a supervisor in training, but also feeling as though I didn't really have the language to articulate the difficulties that I was having. I had the privilege of working with faculty who had years of experience supervising and having open conversations about topics like identity and multiculturalism. But even though we were having those conversations, there were still some difficulties that I was personally having operating in that space as the only supervisor in training that was a person of color, and bumping up against these issues around identity. So it was really very early on having those experiences and then connecting with colleagues, other Black women, really just initiating conversations, asking people, have you had similar sorts of experiences? Am I alone in this? I don't think that I am. In those conversations, I started to hear, yes, actually, I have had similar experiences. And so it was really organic, seeking out support from other supervisors of color who are part of my support system and network already. And it really came from personal clinical experiences.
So it's interesting. I teach in one of only two MFT programs housed within a school of social work at the University of Louisville and Kent School of Social Work and Family Science. So my students get 2 degrees and they have kind of dual citizenship. They're MFTs and social workers. And I've been in this profession, it's my 25th year, but I was trained by social workers, the first generation MFTs that were social workers. But there are many similarities and distinct differences between the professions. But as social workers, this is just Eli's opinion, do a better job of bringing up social location and things like race. Whereas MFT has certainly made strides, but it strikes me that you had to find, and thankfully you did, other strong female African-American voices to talk about this, but it didn't come up in your supervision of supervision class the way it probably should have. Would you say that's accurate?
I would. And I also want to give credit where it's due with the supervisors that were training me at the time. I think they definitely attempted to make space for us to be able to talk about social locations, but I was still very internally having a difficult time in figuring out how do we move from having the somewhat abstract theoretical types of conversations to thinking about what happened practically when I am sitting across from supervisees who might be white or right. might be older.
How do we make it right. real? How do we take it from the abstract into a real life situation happening in the room, which is now the beautiful thing about you all collaborating on this article we'll talk about today. Now you have something that can be part, and hopefully it will be if it's not already a part of AMFT's supervision course. So it builds the dialogue in a way that it wasn't before. So we'll get to that. But Carmen, tell me how you and Leslie hooked up.
My story is similar to Leslie's, which I think helped. When we met each other, I felt a sense of validation and connectiveness in hearing her story, because I too experienced these differences when I entered into my doctoral program, and it was my supervision of supervision class where I started to notice these differences, very similar to her experience. But I did meet Leslie through the AMFT Minority Fellowship Program. We are both alumni fellows of the program. And I was so thankful.
It's a great program.
It really is, simply because it brought me a community. I was able to connect with a tribe of strong Black women that have truly been supportive throughout this whole process, even after. We're all graduated now and we are all still connected. And I truly lean on them for support, not only in navigating the practice that I'm currently in, staying connected to academia, and just having that sounding board and that community when I'm noticing struggles and needing to reach out with people that are able to offer that support. So that was how we met. And it was through the shared experiences that, for me, contributed to my desire to be a part of this project and to be a part of this research. For me, when I'm looking for maybe additional information or different perspectives to help me understand a phenomenon, I go to the literature. And so when I was in the middle of this and I was still struggling in my supervisory space, I was going to the literature to try to get more answers. And I noticed that there wasn't as much available. And so I found that to be alarming, as the researcher in me was like, okay, I know I'm not the only one that's experienced this. I cannot be the only one. And so now, having connected with people in real life and then understanding that they have a shared experience, and then all of us feeling called or motivated to put something together and put it out there. So my hope is that through this article and the continued discussions that we're having, other students who may be experiencing this, if they turn to the literature to help make meaning of their experience, that they will find more, that there will be something there that will help guide them through their process of discovery as well.
I want you to give a shout out to your other authors. Sometimes I find that two people is the perfect amount of guests to have on a podcast, but I want to give respect to this whole team that put this article together. And I'm guessing it's part of this strong cohort of Black doctoral MFTs that you met at MFP, but I'm not sure. So give a shout out to the rest of your colleagues.
Absolutely. They are also alums of the MFP. So there's Dr. Maxine Notice, who is faculty at Abilene Christian University there in Texas. And then also Dr. Jocelyn Armstrong, who's at Lewis and Clark in Portland, Oregon. Some amazing scholars.
That's great. And what a great advertisement for the MFP program that we've talked about, and it has created so many lasting connections and a vital part of the AMFT. All right, so now I want everybody to read the article. And obviously, if you're a member of the AMFT, you get free access to JMFT, but we'll give people a preview here. So first of all, for those people that are not research savvy, this is a qualitative design. Describe in layman's terms what a modified Delphi study is, so they can understand how you even put this together.
In very lay terms, Delphi study is a type of research method where you collect data from a panel of experts on an identified topic. And so for our study, we recruited individuals who identify as persons of color. And because it again really focuses on individuals who are considered to be experts, we also included in the inclusion criteria, they needed to have at least 10 years of clinical supervisory experience within the field of systemic therapy. And so the Delphi study really allows you as a researcher to go through this very iterative process of collecting information from this panel. And so you go through multiple rounds of data collection. And so it really is a rigorous process of reaching some type of consensus on your given topic. And so because of the rigorous nature of the approach, and because you're looking for individuals who are really experts, these are usually sample sizes that are not very large, but collectively, we were getting information from people who, on average, had just under 18 years of clinical supervisory experience. So the data is really rich. We invited people to go through three rounds of data collection in order for them to reach consensus on the question that we were asking.
Tell us a little bit about your demographics, because MFT in the big mental health professions is the smallest anyway, but we're talking about now really senior people that have this experience. Now, because you all are so passionate, I would also imagine the type of people you were recruiting being able to put a voice to their experience. So in some ways, you think of this as a small but probably very vocal group of wanting to share their experience. So how many people did you end up with, and what is the demographic breakdown of the people you interviewed?
Yeah, so we had 9 individuals to agree to participate in this study. We ended up having to exclude the data from 1 individual because they unfortunately didn't meet each of the inclusion criteria that we had established, but they were all females with the exception of 1 person. 3 of them identified as Asian or Pacific Islander, 3 as African American or Black, and then 1 person identified as being Black Canadian / Caribbean, and then 1 person identified as being multiracial. They were also all residing in the U.S., with the exception of 1 person who actually resided in Canada. And then 6 of the panelists had terminal degrees in couple or marriage and family therapy or a closely related field. And then 1 person was currently working towards their terminal degree. And then 1 person was also a master's level clinician, but they had extensive supervisory experience. And then the average age was just over 48 years.
And talk about the types of questions, because again, we're all curious by nature as clinicians, as systemic therapists, and being a qualitative researcher is in some ways not that much different than being a therapist, is letting your curiosity lead.
So initially, we had them to respond to a series of open-ended questions. We wanted to get an understanding as to what they consider to be foundational principles that are central to effectively teaching and training therapists on how to then become effective supervisors. And then we gradually moved into wanting to understand if they felt as though being a person of color really necessitated a different level of training, or if there needed to be like different areas of focus or more emphasis, I should say, on particular topics. And so we asked them, like, if you feel like that's true, like, what are these pertinent issues or topics that you feel like could be more salient to supervisors of color who are then being trained to be supervisors? We also wanted to know if their education and training prepared them to address particular issues around race, multiculturalism, as well as social justice, and if they recall there being specific topics being discussed in their training. So, for example, did you receive any training or knowledge around how to address microaggressions when they come from your supervisees, or managing different challenges that might be associated with conducting cross-cultural supervision, or having to navigate these intersectional identities, which is a really key aspect of the paper?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. How does applying an intersectional framework impact systemic supervision, do you think?
So intersectionality really stems from critical race theory in some ways. It forces us to really call attention to intersecting identities. And so it was interesting because in the traditional way that we've been taught to think about intersectionality as put forth by scholar Kimberly Crenshaw is to think about Black women and how when we think about the experiences of Black women, we can't only think about their racial identity. We can't only think about their gender identity, but we have to think about how those identities intersect to create some very unique experiences. And so for our study, we really took that conceptualization and thought about how supervisors of color are not only operating in this position of power and in a position of authority as a supervisor, but that we also have to consider how their personal identity as a person of color also shows up and impacts the dynamics that are at play between them and their supervisee. So in our paper, we talk about there being an intersection of a professional identity, being a supervisor, but also their personal identity, being a supervisor that is a person of color. And so because of that, our argument is that makes for a very unique, complex interplay of identities.
Because in one hand, yes, a position of authority or power supervisor, and then perhaps a position of being underrepresented or disenfranchised as a minority, in this case, African-American female. It really is an intersection in a complex identity. Yeah, how do we handle that, Carmen?
And so I think that is what is the area of intersectionality, especially as you're training as a supervisor of color, that inherent to the position of a supervisor is the responsibility to navigate both privileged and marginalized identities. So it is important that we, the supervisor, along with our supervisees, are learning, discussing, and maybe even just acknowledging the ways that our minoritized identities show up in the space. And how do we manage our privileged identities that show up in that space, and especially if they tend to conflict for the people that are engaged in the relational dynamic? The other part I'd like to highlight is when we're thinking of this as our training for preparing other therapists to facilitate therapy, that they will then be in rooms with clients that have intersectional identities. And they're having to experience maybe their difficulties, their marriage, their lives, and encountering how those identities manifest. So like Leslie was saying, it's not just looking at you as a woman of color being in the dynamic, but you're also in a position of power, of gatekeeping. When you are supervising, you are one of the gatekeepers for our profession. And with that comes the institutional power and the power given by the states of licensure and even the association. So it can be difficult at times when you are sitting in a position of institutional power with someone that may have societal power or a societal privileged identity, and if there are any conflicts that may arise in that situation.
If you had to distill down for our listeners the most important kind of clinically significant findings, so to speak, from this Delphi study, what would those be? What are things that have the possibility to, again, shape our field in positive ways moving forward?
So for me, I think about very specific experiences that I've had leading supervision for students and moments that I needed some type of really like a practical tool or something that would have helped me to be able to navigate these instances where it's more than just about having knowledge and awareness around social identities and social locations. So I can increase the awareness of supervisees, but then like, how do I effectively navigate these things in real time as they come up? So just a very simple, yet I think meaningful example that comes to mind for me is working with two supervisees. One was a Black male who was relatively close in age to me. And the other supervisee was an older white female who was probably about 20 years or so my senior. And there was an incident where the white woman supervisee made a very racially charged comment in the process of supervision that was deeply offensive, in particular to the other supervisee who was a black male. And so the challenge for me then became, how do I attempt to educate this supervisee around like why the comment was offensive to this person, why the comment would not be appropriate to say, definitely not to a colleague, and for sure not to a client that they're working with. So I have to figure out how to provide support to both students, but in very different ways. So for my supervisee of color, I felt that they needed support. They needed validation. They felt like they had been deeply offended. And then the other supervisee needed like education and also support, but also some correcting as well. And so the third layer of that is that, again, remember, this was a racist comment. And so in some ways,
it was more than a microaggression. It was clearly over the top. Yes, no doubt about
and
it.
And so it was also offensive to me. But I'm also in this position as a supervisor. And so I have to figure out how to attend to what is happening for me at an emotional level. I have to attend to what's happening to my supervisee who is offended, the supervisee who needs additional education and training around these things. And so, again, it just makes for an incredibly challenging experience. And so I often think back to that encounter and how I would have benefited from very like practical knowledge that I could have applied that I think could have been useful. And so, again, it's not about the theoretical knowledge, because I think in some ways we do an adequate job around that. But as a mentor of mine used to say, when the rubber meets the road, what do we do in those moments? And how do we better support supervisors of color so that we feel more prepared to navigate those moments?
And I'd like to add also, how do we support, in Leslie's example, her after navigating that situation? That having supports in place of who can you go to, what does that look like? As she said, that she too experienced that. So where does she go and what does it look like when she's needing to be fed as well?
That is a beautiful supervisory example that directly impacted you. What are some other powerful stories or takeaways that came from the research reflected in the article?
I think about the one male participant that we had in the study who identified as Asian and Pacific Islander, and how he talked about having an identity shared with a client that one of his supervisees was working with. So they had a similar identity. He did not disclose like what that identity was, but he also shared that the supervisee was unaware that he shared that identity with the client. And in supervision, that supervisee actually made a discriminatory remark about that identity, unaware that their supervisor held that identity as well. And so he talked about feeling in some ways unsafe in that moment. and definitely unsure about how to move through it in the most effective way. Because again, he found himself also being somewhat triggered or emotionally reactive to what his supervisee had said. He did not talk about if he circled back and had a later conversation with his supervisee, but I think that is very realistic. I think it's those sort of like deer in a headlight types of moments, for lack of a better phrase, where oftentimes supervisors of color are really caught off guard. I think the assumption is that you're in a position of authority, like you're in a position of power. What do you mean? You need to step up and provide direction and provide guidance. And I would agree with that. But I think what is often missing is the true reality that these are, can be really intense moments where we have to think about the power dynamics at play. So I'm working with a white supervisee who might make a very biased or discriminatory remark. I am a person of color as well as their supervisor. And so while it may seem that automatically I feel empowered to take action, to correct, I think the real reality is that supervisors of color sometimes struggle with it. I think it can also be very developmental. I think if we're talking about a supervisor of color who is in their beginning years of development and training, it can take some time. It can take some years under your belt to really develop that skill. Our argument is that we think there needs to be some more resources at the disposal of supervisors of color. As we're working to really foster that skill, as we're working to really develop those muscles, what are things that we can do to better support supervisors of color who are doing incredibly important work to support supervisees?
Yeah, you all found each other as a group of MFPs, minority fellows, and had a built-in support. But if you are the only supervisor of color in your setup, even if you love what you do, finding that voice and getting a plan on how to cope with it is so important. So I'm curious, because I consider you all the leaders in this and part of the difference that is going to make a difference. So what should these resources look like? We often on this show and in this field, we talk about isomorphs or parallel processes. So it's so important to have that dialogue with the supervisee, much like you would have the dialogue with a client, if it could be for a place of increased understanding, a teachable moment and awareness. And I also, in your examples, the difference between individual supervision, where it's one-on-one with the supervisor and the supervisee, when it's a group, it's even more heightened because you have other observers, other group members in the room. So how you handle that as a supervisor is even becomes that much more important. So what do you all think these resources that we need to develop as a field, what should those look like?
So something that we are actively working on is more of a theoretical or conceptual piece that will also further the conversation. So the piece in JMFT is empirical, where we're presenting our findings from the data of the Delphi study. And now collaboratively as a group, we're working on a conceptual piece that will also include some type of practical tool that can be used at multiple levels. So for me, I think a lot about the mentors of supervisors in training and how I think if we're thinking about the issue of power, how mentors have a really powerful role as they're supporting supervisors who are going through their training. I think there are some issues and some topics that are especially crucial to the development and the success of supervisors of color, then mentors should absolutely be having conversations about. I think if we also really apply our systemic lens to this topic, it's also important to acknowledge that when we look at the broader scale, the broader demographic of MFT faculty, MFT supervisors, only a small percentage of our MFT supervisors are actually individuals of color, specifically Black. So the most recent data from COAMPTI is 8 or 9% of supervisors are actually identified as Black or African American. And so for me, that also suggests that if we're thinking about academic institutions and training programs, it is also a good chance that these faculty members and supervisors of color might be like the only person of color on faculty. They might be the only Black or Latino or Asian person within the group of faculty. And they might be supervising groups of students where there are no students of color. And so I think at the very least, when we are engaging in conversations between supervisors and training and their mentors, there needs to be intentional questions being asked around dynamics of race. There needs to be like very close attention being given to those dynamics that are often at play. From my personal experience, and then also from the data that we collected in this study, I think all too often the assumption is that this person, inherent to their positionality, is power. Inherent to their positionality as a supervisor is authority. And that is true. But I think we fall short when we look at that from a very like colorblind lens. We have to incorporate that into our conversations. And so again, one of the resources that we would like to be able to provide is in the works, but we're hoping it is a tool that will help people to think critically about how to navigate these topics and how to intervene when necessary.
And adding to that, from my personal experience of connecting with everyone through MFP, that I think there is an importance of those larger spaces, of being able to connect in those larger spaces, because it can be very isolating. And if we aren't able to see ourselves in the research, see ourselves in the conferences and in the spaces, that we're missing opportunities where we might be able to connect, offer support, and learn from one another about how to support the profession as a whole. In terms of resources, I think this also highlights the importance of those small groups and really fostering the energy of people to attend those groups and to link up with others, especially because the experience can be so isolating and limiting. I'm just thinking of how I felt so seen and validated when I connected with Leslie and some of my other colleagues in MFP.
And I'm thinking that in my role, I certainly hold all the privilege and status that goes with being a white male, an academic, a PhD, and is sometimes in teaching a school of social work where many of my supervisees are minorities and minority females. So I know for me, understanding and just making the space to acknowledge, as you said, just acknowledging their social location, their place, and their, as a therapist in training, as a skilled helper, still trying to be in a position of trying to help someone, but also in a vulnerable state themselves, especially when they are staring across the room from a client or a client system that may be very different than them. So one of the things that AMFT does, obviously, is a refresher course for supervisors. And I often think sometimes for many supervisors who've been doing a long time, those can sometimes be a challenge to get through, or you do some readings and then you have a conversation. But I'm always like, I like seeing the work being done. That's why I loved your stories, because they came to life and they were real life clinical scenarios. So you're talking about putting these tools together. I think seeing this work being done, having a kind of a blueprint of a conversation or how to have those difficult conversations with, on two levels I'm taking away from our wonderful talk today, how supervisor mentors need to be able to have that conversation with the people that are training to be supervisors, and how a supervisor should have that conversation with their therapist in training. I think both of those would be a valued addition, seeing that conversation, like thinking of the story you were telling us and seeing what that would have looked like to educate that white supervisee who made a clearly racist statement, to see what that educational repair would have looked like. Because you told the story, and maybe it's a good way to end, what was the finish of that story? Was there a repair, or did that damage the supervision group moving forward?
Yeah. So what I did not include was that happened in our very first meeting. And it very much, it really, I hate to use this word, but in some ways, I do feel like it tainted the entire experience. I think we struggled as a group. It did not make it safe. Literally, the first meeting we had, that's what happened. And so I struggled as a supervisor in training, and it was incredibly challenging. I think my mentors did as best as they could to try to support me in that. But the other supervisee was just so deeply offended by her comments. It was difficult for him to be able to move past it. And so it was a really complex scenario. And I wish I could say we worked through it and things gelled together. But the truth was that I think throughout the 10-month experience I worked with them, it was a struggle for me and for them.
I have learned so much. I want to give you both of you one last shot for any closing words. I'm fortunate to have you on. And Leslie, there's not many two-time guests, but this was article was so important. I know two close colleagues in my program, both female supervisors of color, both African-American females, and we all read the article at the same time. And it really did speak not only to our group and what we do in a program. So I do want you to know that it is already making a difference. And I believe that if you all continue to work together, and you get venues like not just this podcast, AMFT conferences, leadership symposiums, supervision trainings, that I think it will move the needle to having this very important dialogue. So I can't thank you all enough, but I will give you both the last word. Go for it.
That means so much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate you sharing the impact that the scholarship is already making. And my hope is that as a field, we'll just continue to purposefully be uncomfortable, purposefully have the hard but necessary conversations, because it matters. It matters not just for us as the professionals, but more importantly, it matters for the individuals, the families, the communities that we're serving.
Immensely.
Yes. Thank you for sharing that feedback. We don't often get to hear how the research, once it's put out there, influences and effects. So I'm very grateful that you shared that piece with us here. And again, my hope is that it does continue to move things forward, to have those conversations and give us the experience of learning to be slow to take offense so that we can be uncomfortable and realize that's where the growth is. And that if we are truly looking to take these theoretical concepts and these awareness and put them to the road, as Leslie's mentor said, when the rubber meets the road, and giving people these very actionable, tangible ways to navigate these conversations, then that is the goal. That is something that we're working towards. So thank you for this opportunity.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AMFT? You can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcast and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy, like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com. You see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. and that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors, you want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Rutledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Hear the latest debate with our guests and topics we love.